Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm always very conscious that I've got to start exactly on 8, not before, not after. Considering that we're discussing the prospects or the challenges of a developmental state in South Africa, I think it's appropriate just to send some thoughts to the one man who's played a great role in this. So, Madiba, I hope you're well. Yesterday, Chippy outlined an overview of the environmental issues, and what I want to take from that and stress a little bit is, I think the point we're trying to make, because we run the risk of being a little bit abstract from day-to-day events in this series, but I think the point we're trying to make is that some of these issues are just immensely complex. The choices are difficult, the science is difficult, the technology is difficult. And I think to gloss over those difficulties and not try and get to grips at least with some of the basic structure and architecture of that difficulty will mean that we will not make wise decisions. And whatever states are going to do in the future, I think they're going to have to make some pretty wise decisions. Both globally, because when you looked at what was happening in the environmental area, the slow accumulation of extremely important and very complex international agreements, which will increasingly govern our own operations at an economic level in South Africa, is a very important development. So even though we may be very frustrated that at times this seems to go very slowly, the environmental talks, the trade talks, the fact that they're happening is important. And I think that's also for South Africa, we sometimes rightly are critical, but in the process forget that we have made quite considerable institutional progress in setting up environmental issues and institutions, despite some of the fairly trenchant criticisms that Chippy made of them yesterday. So tonight I'd like to look at what I think is probably in the same order of magnitude as a challenge for modern states, which is energy. Two very closely linked, as we'll discuss in a moment. Now, I'm not an expert on energy. I learned about energy in the School of Hard Knocks. I learned that bolts don't go well with turbines. I learned that you should treat the word sabotage with a pinch of salt. And I learned that if you get your coal wet, it has the same effect as getting your powder wet. The energy doesn't flow. But it's quite clear that energy, and it's a massive system. I'm going to focus tonight on electricity, but when you think of energy, you're thinking of all the fuels used for heating, for a whole host of activities, human activities. Ordinary cooking in households, using wood. So the full spread of the energy system is really very, very complex. And in the readings, we did mention this, what I think is an amazing book by David Mackay on sustainable energy. It's also available on the website. I really would urge you to have a look at it. It's a brilliant discussion of the United Kingdom's choices, but it's just a host of fascinating and important information that he provides as well. The real issue in why energy and environment are so closely linked, it would seem, is that humans have been able to significantly change the overall carbon balance in the planet. So basically what we've done is to release carbon into the atmosphere at a rate which, it would seem, the oceans, plant life and others cannot absorb. So you're beginning to get a serious imbalance. I mean, this, I think as the science unfolds, which is unfolding rapidly, I mean, this might be a really fundamentally serious problem. So on energy, we can't afford not to take it really very seriously. And what I'm going to try and do this evening is stand back a little bit. I'm not going to get immediately involved in discussions about the alternates and the issues we're looking at, because I think the energy system is so deeply embedded into our economies that we often just take it for granted. We don't fully understand the absolute centrality of these energy systems. And as I say, I'm going to focus on electricity. And the first point I really want to expand on, with a bit of thought, all of you will, I'm sure, come to the same conclusion, but modern energy systems, and let's just for the moment focus on electricity to make it a bit easier, are actually completely integrated with three other very big infrastructure systems. You can't conceive, as we'll explore in a moment, you can't conceive of a modern energy system without a highly developed communication system. You can't conceive of a modern energy system without a highly developed logistical system, transportation. And because of our high dependence on fossil fuels, you can't conceive of large energy systems without access to water. So you've got four extremely critical infrastructural systems that actually depend one on the other. They can't be separated at all in a modern energy system. Energy itself, or electricity, communication, logistics, and water. And in South Africa, that last one happens to be extremely important. So, when I talk about an electricity system, we're essentially talking about these massive grids that have been developed across countries. Now, interestingly, of course, electricity doesn't have to have a grid. I can generate electricity using a generator or a small hydro station or a host of ways. Or I can use battery power. So it doesn't have to have a grid. The trouble is that modern economies, particularly the more advanced they are, the more industrial they are, the more they actually require that grid. In fact, it's a precondition. It's integral to the fact that they're advanced economies. So, what is a grid? I mean, a grid, I think, is an amazing network. I've got a sense of it. If you go and sit in just South Africa's command posts, and South Africa is a pretty big system. I mean, although we are top 30 economy, we've got a large electricity grid. And you sit there, and it's exactly about twice the size of this. And many of you may have seen this, but it's about twice the size of this. And it looks like exactly like air traffic management control. There's continual massive array of computers, massive array of screens, and there are people sitting there, and there's someone sitting exactly where I am who's making sure that that grid doesn't collapse. Because basically the grid has to be kept in a constant tension. If it drops outside certain megahertz ranges, it's going to start collapsing. We've seen this in recent times. We've seen a very significant collapse, I think, 2 years ago in Europe. We saw a significant collapse in California. So this is a living thing. It's got to be watched 24 hours a day, every second. It's got to be kept in process. And really, the four components of this grid, that part of it which provides the base load, i.e. its amount of electricity that's provided 24 hours a day, every day of the year, reliably across the grid. So it's that amount of electricity that the economy uses as a base. Now what happens in our demand, as you all know, is it fluctuates during the day, it fluctuates by season, it fluctuates over hours, it can fluctuate according to weather conditions. So this is an extremely dynamic and volatile situation. Which means then that you've got to have a certain quantity of generating capacity. We're going to look at all the options later. A certain quantity of generating capacity that's capable of doing that continuously. That means you've got to have another quantity, usually called mid-merit, which can be brought on to deal with fairly well-established peaks. So we might bring on a station that was idle at lunchtime, but we bring it on in the evening. This is a kind of reserve margin. which we're going to look at later. What is the reserve margin of this energy system? Then you need peaking plants, plants that can be brought in either because of a short-term spike, it's a hell of a cold night in July, or a station goes down somewhere else and you've got to bring in a peaking plant, or it's also part of your reserves. In South Africa, in our crisis, we've used these open-cycle gas turbines here in Atlantis and Mossel Bay basically as mid-merit plants, which is crazy. We've used them often. Yeah. And finally, and very importantly, not something that most of us laypersons know much about, is the concept of energy storage. You need places where energy can be stored. And this, as we'll see later, is absolutely critical when we come to renewable component of the grid. What is energy storage? It's something that allows you to just start up, preferably in seconds, a source of energy. We in South Africa, we have some big storages. We use water pump storages. So you use electricity to pump water up, and then you drop it down when you need it. So we've got one, a small one here in the Cape, and then some really very big ones in the Drakensberg. And what that is you've used energy when you have it. So that's why it's storage. Energy can't be stored as electricity easily. There's some technical exceptions to that. But basically, I can't store the electricity, so I have to store another form of energy, which will make electricity for me. So it could be water that drops down, or in Europe, they've got some big flywheels. There are a host of other things. Later on, we'll just touch on it very briefly, although it's the fascinating thing, whether your transport system couldn't be a storage system. So four concepts you have to have in mind on a grid. There's got to be a significant base load. There's got to be what they call mid-merit, something you can bring in over fairly sustained periods of time. There's got to be something that you can bring in on the peaks, and it would be wise. Most systems that I'm aware of probably all have a storage capacity somewhere. It's usually water, it's the most common, but it can be others. So, and the grid, of course, is then got to be conceived of as its generating capacity, transmission of electricity across long distances where you lose electricity. Remember that, a significant loss of electricity as I transport it over long distances. And then the distribution system within looking at the end users. So these are big, big systems. And I'm stressing that because when we start looking at some of the intricacies of this, they're very, very expensive. Most of Africa, which is a problem, most of Africa does not have a grid, i.e. their economies depend on isolated generation of electricity for specific purposes. Usually diesel, occasionally odd coal-fired station. Very expensive. Now, this grid factor that I'm stressing a little bit, I just want to illustrate how important it is for a modern economy. We kind of take it for granted, and I'm going to do it through a few kind of stories or anecdotic examples. Basically, all forms of modern manufacturing, by modern I mean mechanized and relatively precise, require a constant and stable electricity grid. By stable, I mean the electricity energy stays within a very, very narrow band. So let me illustrate. We Volkswagen built a diesel engine plant in Uitenhage. Modern diesel engines require high degrees of precision to get the power that we have. So particularly the cylinders going through the pistons going through the cylinder, it's extremely precise. And that is cut, as one can imagine, with a lathe, a cutting thing. But it has to be precise. So if the electricity drops outside the prescribed band, there's an imperfection in the cylinder. And so two points I'm making. One is that South Africa can only contemplate that kind of investment, advanced diesel engines, very good for our economy, if it's got constant electricity. Nigeria The whole of the rest of Africa cannot, the whole of the rest of Africa, no other exception, cannot contemplate that form of investment. So if I'm talking about investment, I'm talking about that. We tend to think of clothing and textiles as something simple. Modern weaving machines and knitting machines are of the same nature. They're driven by control and instrumentation equipment, and the energy must remain the same. So yes, I can have a textile industry in Nigeria, but it can't necessarily be sophisticated industrial fabrics or 400 knot sheets or anything else like that, that we buy, these 400 knot, 300 knot sheets. That's sophisticated knitting machines or weaving machines, which require electricity. So virtually every form of advanced manufacturing, mineral beneficiation, I can't have energy problems if I want to beneficiate the mineral, if I want to smelt it from a bauxite or from a chromium or from an iron into something else. I can't have something that stops. I'm going to mess up my equipment if it does. So I'm trying to stress that it is not possible to be a modern economy with modern manufacturing if you do not have reliable energy. By reliable, I don't just mean it's there. I mean it's delivered constantly at the same intensity of energy all the time, 24 hours a day, right around the clock. The second reason why this is really crucial, why the links become important, and here we're starting to see this massive link between communication and electricity, constantly. Eskom has the biggest fiber optic spread outside of the telecommunications networks. In fact, it forms the basis of our second telecoms work. And that's to monitor, continuously monitor its stations, see what's happening. But if we were to compare South Africa and South Korea, as one example, we are absolutely appalling in our energy efficiency. We use things wastefully and badly. There's one city that I'm aware of, maybe it's changed, but one city I'm aware of, which is Bloemfontein, which can centrally switch on and off your geysers. I don't know, they can't do it over the whole of Bloemfontein, they can do a large part. South Korea, every major city, at the center, I can switch off your geyser. But that can only happen because I've got sophisticated broadband network links with you. And this broadband is crucial. This is not telephone wires. This is fiber optic cables carrying massive amounts of information. If I'm monitoring every single geyser in the whole of South Africa or in the whole of Cape Town, and I want that information to get from Cape Town to Germiston, where the command center is, I need really big fiber optic cables to get all that information through. Because what I'm monitoring is the usage, are you using it, are you not using it, and these can be extremely sophisticated. You can start switching off lights, you can start doing this, you can do that. And without any question whatsoever, unless we in South Africa rapidly modernize our distribution networks and our user networks using advanced communication systems, we will have serious problems. And we're already far behind the curve because electricity was so cheap, something I'll come to later. And finally, just think about it, and I think you raised this yesterday. The internet depends on a stable electricity grid. It can't exist outside of it. If you don't believe me, go and try and send a SMS or an email in Addis Ababa. See how lucky you get. It needs a stable electricity system. In fact, interestingly, in my view, for the impact on South Africa, and last night you talked about the amount of energy it uses to do a Google search. I mean, I think one of the things we completely missed in all projections of South Africa user electricity was the massive growth in telecommunication and internet. So the internet requires it. The internet's needed for communication, broadband. So these things are completely integrated. You can't have an electricity grid without an advanced communication grid. And the logistics is also important. Let me mention that very quickly. Coal, I used to think coal was coal. Coal's not coal. Coal has many different calorific values. So each deposit of coal will have a different calorific value, might also have various impurities and other things in it. So I've got to get the right calorie. When I design an electricity station, I can design it for low calorific value or for high calorific value. So one of the reasons why South Africa has such massive electricity stations is because we burn low calorific value coal. So the bigger the amount of coal you use, the bigger the boilers have to be, the bigger the ash extractors have to be, the bigger everything has to bloody be. So we build these giant things not just because we're grand, because it makes some sense, because our coal, we've got more low calorific value coal than we have high. But that means I've got to move that coal to that station for 60 years. That's a very big logistics system. And as we've seen, suddenly, like in South Africa, if you've ever been to Mpumalanga in recent times, the roads are a mess. Because we used to move coal by rail, now we have to move it by road, and it's ruined the roads. So these logistics systems are crucial for the supply of coal-fired stations. For others, of course, it's going to be fairly different. So I'm trying to see how linked these are, because when I'm talking about energy, I'm actually talking about virtually my total infrastructure system. And it can't just be built piecemeal. It's got to be built together. Then let's look at another issue which we just take for granted. Although most political leadership and most states don't take this for granted at all. It's probably number one issue that they look at in everything. And that's the question of energy security. Now, coal-fired stations, nuclear stations, have long lives, going to 60 years now. Wind, solar, and other renewables can be renewed at a relative, their capital replacement costs relatively low, so you can conceive of them as being there for a long time. The sun, as we'll come to later, seems to be there all the time. But energy security is a difficult concept. If I haven't got coal in my economy or my nation state, I've got to import it. Immediately a problem. Where am I getting it from? And I've got to import that same quality for 60 years. So I must be fairly confident that my supplies of coal are coming from somewhere that I can rely on. Australian floods, coal gets a problem. You see what happens. Even in South Africa, with some of the biggest coal reserves in the world, if we export all the coal, we haven't got it. So we have to have a system where we say, no, no. South Africa's stations must be supplied first. To not supply them first would be plain lunacy. But coal's in high demand. 6 or 7 years ago, India didn't import any coal from South Africa. They've got their own deposits. But for a whole range of reasons, they started building some big power stations on the coast, and they now import 12 million tons of coal out of some 65 million or so million tons that we export. So the security of my primary energy, as the nuclear industry grows, the demand for uranium grows. How do you secure that supply? I'm talking about the basic uranium now, I'm not even talking about the enriched uranium. Now you might think, well, look, solar will solve that. Depends, as we'll come to later, what role solar plays in your grid. But you see they've started to build a massive project in Algeria called Desertec, which is a giant solar project. Now that's got to, for the United Kingdom to use it, it's moving 700 or 800 kilometers. That's a very vulnerable supply line. Are we being unrealistic? Of course not. Anyone who's been watching European energy history for the last 4 years will know that Russia holds everyone by the... I was going to use a bad term, but Russia holds them by the famous saying, if you've got them by their hearts and minds will follow. I mean, Russia, this gigantic flow of gas, and Russia turned it off for Belarus. So energy security is really quite a serious issue, because it also means, now how big is my reserve margin? You know, If I'm going to import from the gigantic Inga Dam project in the Congo, and I'm traveling 1,000, 2,000 kilometers, if I were buying 40% of my electricity from that, am I wise? What happens if someone decides to break down the lines, or someone decides to stop the plant because there's a revolution in DRC? Fairly likely prospect. Now all of a sudden 40% of my electricity is not there. So by and large, more and more countries would not import. I mean, UK and most of Europe is actually a bit of an exception for this. Would not import more than their reserve margin. Because that's a fairly dangerous strategic position to be in. I think it's a very, very difficult issue. South Africa, we are so fortunate, we've discussed this before, we've got massive primary energy resources. But we're one of the exceptional countries in the world that has this kind of primary energy resource. And my view is that the reason why nuclear energy has suddenly risen, despite all the difficulties with it that we'll look at later, is almost entirely driven, in my view, by the security issue linked to trying to reduce emissions. But the security issue, in my view, ranks higher. Because in France, if you go and read the history of the French energy system, number one strategic priority after 3 centuries of war was we are going to be energy self-sufficient. You can go and read that. That's why they went nuclear. It's the only known system where I can have a generation plant that is dependent on a fuel, but the quantities are manageable. I can find those quantities. I'm not moving 50 tons of coal every year into my system. Absolutely decisive issue. I think anyone who ignores that in the geopolitics of energy is just naive. Now let me come to another system, and I'm sorry, another problem or issue. Probably, practically speaking, the most difficult problem for developing countries by far. And that is the macroeconomics of building an energy system. What do I mean by that? Energy in the base load as we now have it, we'll look at the important qualifications and modifications we have to make about this when we look at more significant use of renewables. But for the current system, where 80% plus is fossil fuel, 10-12% nuclear in the base load, across the world, you are building big capital plants with a life of 60 years. So the initial capital cost is high, lower for coal, and operating costs high for nuclear, low operating costs. But essentially the total cost of these big baseload plants is very, very high. And they've got to be in a system. So what economic model do you want to use for this? Let me spell that out a bit as an economic. All parts of your economy use electricity. So the cheaper the electricity, the cheaper your product, isn't it? If electricity is going to be financed on what's called, those old characters like me who remember the big debates about planning, if it's financed on full cost recovery, then your electricity must get more expensive. And the impact on the rest of the economy must also be quite significant. So in South Africa, we built a big system, and that's the next choice you make. Historically, for fairly obvious reasons, virtually every major electricity system in the world was built by the state, either through big state-owned enterprises, or utilities as they used to be called, or like in the United States, through massive support from the fiscus through guarantees for insurance and stuff like that. But there is no major energy system that you'll find anywhere in the world where the state didn't play the absolutely decisive role, and usually still does in one or other way. So that means that the state, is it subsidizing that from its general revenue? Is it trying to recover the cost of the electricity at full cost? Or is it halfway between? And basically, most systems are halfway between. The state does, in one or other way, underwrite the investment. But more and more, especially over the last 30 years, big energy systems have moved towards full cost recovery, including here in South Africa. So we've tried to move Eskom from a state utility to a company, so it operates on full cost recovery within a regulated industry. We just don't have time to go into regulation, a very complex and difficult issue. So the model we've got is one which says it is wiser to recover your costs of the energy system from the rest of the economy. We've actually built a very big system because we cross-subsidize all over the place. For example, we cross-subsidize between urban and rural. If you were to charge the full cost of a connection to a rural place, and I pay it myself sometimes, it would be much higher than it currently is. So we charge the urban link connections more than it actually costs, and we subsidize the rural and charge them less than it actually costs. The same with all big users. We charge them more than it actually costs us to deliver the electricity to them, because we then use that income to finance places where it costs us more to deliver than they're actually paying. And in South Africa, we've built, I think, a very innovative and interesting system of free basic electricity, which we then subsidize. So we've developed a model, which I think is a pretty pragmatic, useful model, where if you want something to happen at a low cost or subsidized cost, the state pays it from the budget. But within the system, we try and operate a full cost system. Except we don't yet charge for two things correctly. We do not charge for the cost of building the much more expensive new generating capacity. And we do not fully internalize. Internalize means taking the cost from outside and putting it in, the cost of carbon emissions. So we don't, and other particulate emissions and stuff like that. So we've built a model where it's a mixture of state. We're trying to bring the private sector in South Africa, which I think would be an exceptionally important and wise move. But we could spend time, if you want to, for a host of financial and risk reasons. We've been singularly unsuccessful thus far in bringing in the private sector. Not because Eskom's a big monopoly, but because we haven't got our economic model right. We're not getting the costing right. We're not offering the right prices yet. Starting to get there a little bit, but we're still far away. The basic rule that you can think of is that an old station is going to be lower cost than a new, because I've got amortized assets, whereas a new one, I'm building a new thing with much more expensive capital equipment. I'm trying to bring in the externalities of the costing, so that it's going to be more expensive. The reason why most states keep a state system is that I can then manage my risk profile, I can manage my average marginal cost profile, sorry to be technical, across a fairly wide spread. The alternate, which doesn't exist in practice, the closest anyone got to it was California, is that you have these things called independent power producers. So the private sector comes in, invests in a power station, and you pay for it. To do that, we don't have time to look at this, you have to have a very sophisticated transmission system with a national buyer, a market, and all sorts of things like that. What California taught us was that because of the size of these electricity systems, and because there's a lot of risk attached to it, there's political risk, now there's environmental risk. I mean, if I'm the owner of a coal-fired station, my future prospects may not be that good. So there's a lot of risk. So there's a lot of risk, and I'm a big private investor. I don't go and invest in upgrading my station. So what happened was the private investors reduced their levels of investment. Similar phenomenon you may remember happened in British Rail. And at a point, when a crisis happened, the plants weren't up to it. They couldn't carry the burden. So I don't think any major system in the world will ever be privatized. Oh, sorry, we'll get questions then. So I don't think any major system will be fully privatized. It's a complex mixture of the private and the public. A really difficult choice. I've glossed over what I think are some of the most interesting and problematic issues in an energy system. Because most of the public discourse is about we should have IPPs, with very little knowledge about what an IPP is, how it fits into the system. We should have IPPs, but to bring them in is not as easy as it would seem. We need also then, as we're now starting to do, if you want the renewables, and Chippy quite rightly pointed out that we're pathetic on renewables in South Africa. If you want them, then you've got to be capable of paying them much higher prices, because it costs them more to put it in. But, as I said, in South Africa, we haven't factored in the cost of building these things. So let me give you some experience I had. When it was clear we had to build massive new capacity, we signed off as government on two stations that Eskom was going to build. Big stations, 4,200 megawatt stations, Medupi and Kusile. When I first saw the presentation on Medupi as the minister responsible, the cost was 42 billion rand. 42 billion rand. I think current cost is 140 billion rand. Not through inefficiency or issues. At one point, we could not... You have to... If you want a generator, the one that my bloody bolt messed up, if you want a generator or a boiler or anything like that, you pay millions of dollars to book the slot 10 years ahead. I want to repeat that. Millions of dollars to book the slot 10 years ahead. So Eskom had fortunately booked all those slots. If they hadn't, Botswana hasn't, and therefore their project hasn't gone ahead. So the cost is rising, because there's a gigantic expansion of energy systems around the world. China, India, everyone's buying these things. There are only about 10 companies that can make sophisticated big turbines and boilers. And if I'm Siemens, the famous Siemens company, and Germany starts to rebuild its coal-fired power stations, and there's a choice between supplying Germany and South Africa, what's your guess? What's your guess? I'm not telling you fibs. We had that exact experience. Siemens is a very important company in South Africa. When we wanted stuff from them, they couldn't supply it because they were supplying Germany. So the cost of these systems, things is rising. So our electricity price, already we've fallen behind. In fact, as we now stand, my guess is that 2012, 2013 will be exceptionally difficult years in South Africa. Because we've had to slow down on Kusile. Why have we had to slow down? Because the tariff doesn't cover the full cost of the operation. It doesn't cover the cost of the electricity and the new build and the cost of bringing in renewables. So we have to double at a minimum electricity prices, and we haven't done that yet. We're not close to it. So, point I want to make on this macro issue. I think South Africa is correct in the model it's built of trying to have a mix between state, private, recover the costs in full cost recovery, nearly. I think that's the correct model. But we haven't got it working properly. The tariffs are too low, And we haven't worked out all sorts of other complicated issues. Some of you here are probably experts on this, but very complicated issues like linking to the grid, the single buyer, single seller, all this kind of stuff, which I'm happy to go into in questions. But, so we're roughly on the right track, but our model's not yet working. So the rate of investment in energy is dropping, and we had a crisis in 2007, 2008. I was the poor sucker in charge of the crisis. We're going to have another crisis soon, and another poor sucker will be in charge of it. So what we have to get to grips with is that for South Africa, we have to significantly increase our electricity prices if we want to build new capacity. So having said all that, just consider Africa. You know, I've got an economy that can't borrow money on the capital market. We can in South Africa. No one will take my guarantee if I'm DRC. And I've got no energy. And I've got to build a big system. It's a tragedy. No one will take the risk of financing a big project because the risks are too great. So when we talk about development in Africa, the first and foremost issue is energy. And as we saw last night, that means that the first and foremost issue is environment and energy. And the point I was trying to stress to you is there's no such thing as an electricity grid if there's no communication system, no logistics system, and no water. Water's often not a problem for parts of Africa. So we, in my view, we face a really serious infrastructural crisis in Africa. And most of the stuff that we drivel about, development and all of these things, are really missing the point entirely. There won't be a lot of development unless we get the energy right. And you're not going to get the energy right unless you've thought through your environmental policy, as we discussed last night. So I just want to make two more points which I should have made earlier. Often you say, well, the government should pay for Eskom. All right? The Eskom bill, leave out nuclear now. Leave out big solar, concentrated solar power. Just talk about the forthcoming coal and some wind and maybe solar paneling and stuff like that. Just talk about that for a moment. You're looking at about 400 billion rands worth of investment. Just for the stations on the drawing board now. That's the big new pump storages and other things. That's massive. That's massive. So when the state says, all right, I will pay for that, that means that your fiscal deficit will probably treble, not double, treble. Because I'm taking out of a total budget of, what's it, let's say approximately a billion rand, and I'm adding another 400 billion to it if the state's going to pay. Forget it. Fiscal suicide. Because what will then happen is the whole economy will get hammered. As people say, oh, I'm not lending South Africa anymore, man. Look at these stupid characters. They're paying for their whole electricity system. They haven't got the money to do it. They've got to pay for education, health, HIV and AIDS, all sorts of other things. So when they want to borrow money, when I used to lend it to them at LIBOR plus 100 basis points, I'm now going to lend it at LIBOR plus 3%, which means the price of money rises in the economy, not for all of you. For all of you. It means consumer spending expenditure drops, it means small and medium business goes bankrupt, and the economy suffers. So I'm trying to illustrate that your energy system is a macroeconomic issue, how I finance it. If I try and finance it on budget, I'll probably have a fiscal crisis. If I don't give it some support, it won't take place. A very sophisticated, subtle, fine balance between fiscal policy and the private sector. Really an interesting phenomenon all economies are grappling with. So, we're starting to get close to the end of time. Now let's get to the controversial ones in a way. And here again, one of the most great discussions of this is here. The first point I'd make is that in order for our energy system to be sustainable, it has to have three dimensions, and Chippy almost covered that. Firstly, it's got to be sustainable from a security point of view. Remember the point I made earlier, i.e. it can get access to supplies of energy. Secondly, it's got to be sustainable from a socio-economic point of view. If I live in Uganda currently, electricity costs me about 8 times what it costs a South African household. It's a tragedy. Poor country, electricity, which we need for children, education, all these, costs about 8 times ours. So it's got to be security, socioeconomic, and then environmentally. And these things have to be melded. So what we know is that there has to be a sustained and concerted movement away from fossil fuels, carbohydrates. The pace at which that can happen and all the technologies that are surrounded, for a layperson, we also put this on the reading list, the sustainable fossil fuels. I think if you're really interested in energy, go and have a look at this. It deals with all the issues about how you could also improve coal, which there's no question we're going to have to improve coal technologies. Deals with these issues of carbon sequestration, which I'll look at later. Well, let's not look at it later. Carbon sequestration is to prevent the carbon escaping your generating dimension and to put it somewhere, basically to put it somewhere deep in the hope it doesn't come out again, or to put it back into the oceans, one of the two. Technologies are contemplated for taking it directly out the air, but it's fairly expensive at the moment and difficult technically. So carbon sequestration, all of these issues, different types of coal technologies, all crucial. The options are numerous. I think very often, I was guilty of this. I used to think this was a sort of either-or debate. It's not. What we know for certain is renewables have to come in. What we know for certain is that we need baseload capacity. And my own view is that probably a small minority of the world's countries, out of the 160 countries, my guess is if you're going to have about 40 or 50 that will have nuclear power. Nuclear power's got so many technical and other issues confronting it that most economies can't easily sustain that. South Africa would fall into the family of countries that probably could, but it's a complex, expensive process. But for the reasons I mentioned earlier, there is no question in my mind that the big economies will drive this. The United Kingdom is now in the midst of a strong push to revive its nuclear industry. Germany will rebuild nuclear plants very soon, I'm sure. But that's a limited number of countries. And I think this is an argument which requires a great deal of public discussion because nuclear has the particular aspects or the consequences of nuclear accidents are much more serious than others. And we do have the issue of intergenerational equity around storage of fuel. But the mix is there. Now, the points I want to make is, let's go, the renewables, I think we all know roughly what they are. It'll be wind, biomass, solar. Solar's got two parts to it. I can use a photovoltaic process, converting electricity from direct sunpower, or I can use concentrated solar power, taking the sun's rays, concentrating it, and heating some medium and having an ordinary generator moving. There's tidal power. There's tidal flow powers. There's a whole, quite a family of renewables. There's no question about it. I think that the interesting thing about it, and you can see the ratios, by and large, renewables have two things that they have to grapple with. They're not insurmountable at all. These are soluble issues. Firstly, the intermittency. They you can't guarantee them, with especially tide, wind, and solar. Okay, biomass, I probably can. That means that the concept I mentioned earlier of storage becomes critical. So as we build greater renewable energy into our system, we also have to have greater storage capacity. Some of the most interesting ideas, I think, are the link between your transport fleet and your storage. So if you begin electrifying your transport fleet, that fleet, when it's quiet, can be your storage capacity, i.e. the batteries in it can be plugged back into the system. So you can use your transport system, if you electrify it, you can use your railway lines as storage mechanisms by getting the friction off the wheels. You can use many things. So this is not an insurmountable problem, it's just that it's big And it's a relatively new set of technologies, some of these more advanced ones. So the intermittency of that means that at this point, I don't think there's any serious proposition that you could build a system that was only on renewables. If you take into account what I said to you earlier about the need for constant and reliable grid electricity. But you certainly can build more renewables than we've got. You can do a lot. The second problem with renewables, though, which they take much more space per unit of energy than do coal or nuclear. So, for example, if you want to supply Europe's population, just to give you a sense of the orders of magnitude, if you wanted to supply Europe's population with concentrated solar power or photovoltaics or a combination, doesn't really matter, you would have to ask Algeria to give up half its country so that you could put mirrors or whatever in that you wanted. And then you've got to ship it, as I said earlier, I mean, transmit it, that's a few hundred kilometers. So the precise role of renewables, I think they're absolutely critical. In South Africa, they're critical. I mean, obviously, our conclusion we came to quite a time ago is that solar is much more important than wind in South Africa. But the renewables need to be brought in. Currently, they're much higher cost, precisely because their energy, their usable energy, there's a precise term I'm forgetting, their usable energy ratio is much lower than the usable energy ratio of the more conventional coal and nuclear. So planning your renewables is not about trying to be nice and be liked. It's about some extremely careful planning. Where you're going to locate this, what price you're going to put it in, how does it link with the rest of the system. And frankly, in South Africa, I think that's where we've been a little bit weak. So my concluding point, sorry to take so long, I mean, this is such a big and interesting subject. What I think in South Africa, currently it would seem to me that although we had the blackouts and the brownouts and those issues, I don't think that as yet within the popular knowledge and imagination, people have fully come to grips with the severity of this energy issue. Not just for South Africa. I think we still tend to live on the basis of this wasteful electricity usage we had from the past. And we're tending to be a little bit diverted from the hard work of detailed planning by just shooting at each other around either coal or nuclear or renewables. I mean, the reason we're slow on renewables, I think, is not because of lack of will. We made an announcement in the South African government that we'd do 15% by 2 years' time. You know, it was a very brave move. But actually, if you want to do that, you've got some very careful planning to do. You've got a lot of hard work to do, putting the right prices in, all the things that I've discussed earlier. So, to conclude, developmental states are not a nice to have. They're just bloody plain hard work. And what you can't do, as we discussed last night, is to leave this detailed and complex discussion in the hands of a few bureaucrats, no matter how expert they are. You really have to widen it out. And if I were to do a test in this room, I hope I'm going to be proved wrong. I hope so. But if I said, has anyone looked at what Chippy spoke about last night, the integrated resources plan? Some have, okay. The experts, the fundies have. But most people weren't watching the public hearings in Parliament. They weren't looking this up. We should be. We should be. It was an important time. Developmental states, bloody complex. Energy, bloody complex. Energy, bloody essential. And we're moving a little bit slower than we should be for a country like South Africa. Thank you.